This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. Of the five plenipotentiaries who signed the Anglo-Irish Treaty on 6th of December 1921, most attention has been focused on the motivations and actions of Michael Collins and Arthur Griffith, and on the plenipotentiary who wasn't, Eamon de Valera. But what about the other three, Eamon Duggan, George Gavan Duffy, and Robert Barton, particularly the latter, the only one who later took an anti-treaty position? To find out more about this Republican Protestant landlord from Wicklow, I'm joined by John Dorney, editor of the Irish Story website and author of Peace After the Final Battle, The Story of the Irish Revolution, 1912 to 1924. And that was published by New Island Books in 2013. Joan Kavanagh, a member of the Rathdrum Historical Society, the County Wicklow Heritage Forum, and the Glendalough Heritage Forum. Chris Lawler, local historian and author of The Little Book of Wicklow, that was published by the History Press back in 2014. And finally, Catherine Wright, archivist with Wicklow County Council Archives and Genealogy Service. And this HedgeGhoul is supported by Wicklow County Council's Archive Service and the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media under the Decade of Centenaries 2012 to 2023 initiative. Okay, guys, now just to get us started, Joan Kavanagh, if I could go to you, who were the Bartons of Glendalough House? Who was Robert Barton?
Good morning. The Bartons were a family that came into the estate. They bought the estate of Glendalough House in 1838. Thomas Barton was the first Barton to come in, and they bought the estate from Thomas Hugo, or the Hugo family, who was Thomas Hugo was a notorious militia leader in the 1798 rebellion. And Robert Barton inherited the estate. He and his first cousin, Erskine Childers, they were double first cousins. They lived and grew up together in Glendalough House. And by all accounts, the Bartons, not just Robert, but the Barton family, were held in the highest regard in the local community. And
Joan, how many acres are we talking about here, roughly?
Roughly 1,500 acres.
Well, that's big. Like, I mean, this is a major estate.
Yes, and when I've had the great privilege of being able to talk to some people who worked on the estate and whose family worked on the estate, and all of them, to a man and a woman, would say that the Bartons were excellent employers, very decent people, and were not just employers of their of these people, but were considered to be local supporters of business and industry, and really cared for their employees. And reading the memoirs that Robert Barton wrote, he spoke of not of his servants or his tenants, but of his employees and his friends. And he talked about different people like Johnny MacDonald and Dennis Doyle that were friends for 50 and 60 years. So they were highly regarded in the community.
Can I bring Catherine Wright in here? Catherine, just in terms of the Barton papers, which I know the Wicklow Archives have, what sort of stuff do you have then about the estate, about what Joan has just been talking about?
Yes, Tommy, we have quite a collection of papers relating to the Barton estate, 40 plus documents in the collection, and they date from the 1830s when Thomas Johnston Barton first acquired the estate, known as Drummond Estate at that time, from the Hugos. And there's various legal documents, transactions relating to land, wills, marriage settlements, things like that. It really gives a sense of how the estate was run, the extent of it. And there's also several personal items relating to Robert Barton himself, his political career, his military career. So it's quite a collection. It's beautifully described. The former archivist, Cecile Gordon, who's now a senior archivist in the military archive, she did a lovely job and created a lovely detailed descriptive list that's online on wicklow.ie. People can have a look and see the kinds of documents in that collection.
Now, John Dorney, just sort of bringing you in here, because Catherine has mentioned their military background, right? I mean, they had a major British military tradition, right? I mean, so in a sense, they tick all the typical boxes of Protestant landlords in that sense. Just talk to us a bit about that, John.
Yeah, absolutely, Tommy. I mean, one thing as well to mention just ahead of the military stuff is, you know, they were a family of Empire loyalists in the conventional kind of sense. For example, Robert's father, Robert mentions in his Bureau of Military History statement that his father was a great friend of Parnell until Parnell declared for the national cause. Now, of course, Parnell was a fellow Wicklow landlord and a Protestant, of course. But once Parnell became the leader of the Home Rule movement, apparently they never spoke again. So that was the family's politics, you know, in the previous generation. Now, of course, the very interesting thing about the Barton Childers family is a whole generation of them went the other way in the Irish Revolution. But before that, yeah, absolutely, they had a very strong British military heritage. Erskine Childers, as John mentioned, Robert's first cousin, double first cousin, served in the Boer War. And he didn't serve as a regular officer. He served as a volunteer in one of the yeomanry militia units, was the term, but which is the same, of course, as 1798, but is kind of part-time units, a kind of a precursor of the Kitchener's army in the First World War that served in the Boer War. So, you know, it wasn't just out of, you know, professional need. He volunteered to serve the Empire in South Africa. Two younger brothers of Robert Barton died in the First World War. And just to give you an idea, though, of how far this goes back, Dulcibella Barton, Robert's sister, who was a very entertaining Bureau of Military History statement, very kind of wry, but she mentions a raid by the British Army on the house in 1920, you know, during the Black and Tan period. And she says, a corporal came in and he found a lance, and the colonel, she says the colonel was very polite, but she said the colonel asked, what do you want that lance for? And she said, it belonged to my uncle who died in the Zulu War. So Robert Johnson Barton died in the Battle of Halabeen in South Africa in the Zulu War in 1879. So really a very deep tradition of service in the British military, you know, prior to the Irish Revolutionary period. And of course, Robert Barton himself, we'll get on to, I think, you know, his kind of conversion to the national cause, as he put it. But he did join the British Army also. He joined the Dublin Fusiliers in 1915. And he was a serving officer at the time of the Easter Rising. He happened to be sent to Dublin during the Easter Rising. So the family, and of course, Erskine Childers, his cousin, served throughout the First World War almost as well in the British military. So it's certainly very deep and very long-lasting tradition of service to the Empire.
John, just before we get on to his conversion, if you like, right? Is there something in the water in Wicklow with regard to, you know, Protestant landlords? I mean, what I'm getting at is there a Protestant radical tradition that goes back to, you know, Joseph Holt? You've mentioned Charles Stuart Parnell. It does seem pretty, you know, particular to that county.
It does. I mean, no, it's not the only place, of course, where there are Protestant Republicans, but certainly, yeah, there is a tradition of that in County Wicklow, and it does go back to the days of the late 18th century. However, I mean, I think, you know, with the Childers Barton family, they don't necessarily have that tradition. It is, as you say, in the water, or it's part of the political tradition in County Wicklow. But the Barton Childers family weren't of that bent, like they were.
Okay, so they're not of that tradition. Okay, that's you've made that very clear, right? So this is a complete conversion, right? Just before I move on to Chris on that, Catherine, is there much First World War material in the archives in relation to the Bartons?
Well, there's a lovely item regarding Robert Childers Barton's enlistment, and we have a lovely reference from his cousin Erskine Booth, who was a captain based in the Curra at the time. So we actually have his military reference, and Booth recommending that he be given a commission, and basically referring to the fact that he is 34 years of age and he's given up a very large home and farm to enlist to serve his country. So it's quite a nice item to have.
Okay, now Chris, I just sort of bring you in, because this is the big mystery of this story, is, you know, his conversion to republicanism. Now, John has already mentioned that he served in Dublin during Easter 1916. So, like, what sort of experiences did he have?
Well, I think number one, we would have to go back actually further than that to look at the conversion, if you like to call it a conversion, because I think actually the conversion began in his boyhood. I think actually Robert Martin gave an interview to RTE in, I think it was 1969. Now, it's a very short interview, but in that interview, he talked about how he was influenced by, if you like, the county that he lived in and also the people that he lived among. And he went back to 1798 and to the stories of 1798. I think one could nearly draw a kind of a parallel with, we'll say, for example, maybe Douglas Hyde and how he was interested in the, like, you know, the tenants and so forth. Now, of course, actually, Barton didn't call them tenants. He called them employees, as I suppose, you know, Joan has actually mentioned there. And, well, I'm not sure if that was because of the fact that he wanted to actually not to use the language of landlordism, if you like. Yeah, however, I suppose, actually, when he was a young boy, he was, I suppose, actually listening to these kind of stories. And he would have said in that interview that his sympathies actually lay with the people who were the descendants of the people who had been shot in 1798. So first and foremost, he said that that's how he was actually drawn into the national movement. And then, of course, he has, I suppose, what you would call a kind of a typical education for his class. And he actually goes away to rugby school and he goes on to Oxford and then he goes to the agricultural college in Cirencester. Now, there's no doubt that in his Oxford days, he was actually still nationalistic. We particularly know this from a book that was written by a man called Mace, M-A-I-S. And he was in Oxford, actually with Barton. And he says that actually Robert Barton set him actually thinking about how the English treated the Irish, okay, which he called actually barbaric. So I think there was already, if you like, a kind of a nationalistic base there. Like, there's no doubt that it was there from his boyhood. It was there through his years in college as well, obviously. Now, I suppose, actually, moving on from that then, he became converted, if you like, to the cause of home rule. Now, this was particularly so after he had actually toured in rural Ireland with Erskine Childers, his cousin. And possibly Horace Clunker as well. I'm not absolutely sure about that. Like, the sources actually differ. But, okay, certainly when they came back from that particular tour, I think, like, you know, both of the men, actually Barton and also Childers, would have actually spoken of their conversion, if you like, to the cause of home rule. And, of course, we have also got a little bit of information that, I suppose, you know, Dulcie Bella gives in her witness statement, where she says that they took in the Sinn Féin newspaper from the start, more or less. Now, actually, that would have been back in 1906. And we know that in 1907, actually, Barton donated £50 to Sinn Féin. Now, of course, you must remember that actually this was the original Sinn Féin. So therefore, really, like, they weren't anything like the I suppose the later Sinn Féin, which became actually
Republican. They weren't Republican at that stage, at that early stage.
Yes, exactly. They're more for a dual monarchy and so forth. But they had economic policies, I think, that perhaps maybe Barton would have actually supported. So he was now, I suppose, a nationalist. So it was only natural then that when the Irish Volunteers were actually founded in support of Home Rule, that he should become a member. And he did. Yeah, he joined up. So did Erskine Childers, in fact. Childers went off to join the British Navy, and actually Barton then succeeded him as the secretary to the Inspector General, who was a Colonel Moore, actually Morris Moore. But when World War I was going on, though, I think maybe Barton thought that actually very little was actually happening within the Volunteers, and he became maybe little bit maybe disillusioned, if you like. So he went off to join the British Army. And he became a second lieutenant, actually, in the Royal Dublins. Now, he was actually gazetted, actually, back to Dublin in Easter week, 1916. And he arrived into a city which was in turmoil. And he had no uniform, so they sent him home because he couldn't get to his unit. And he went home, and he actually stayed at home for about a week, and then he reported back. And he reported back to a Colonel Esmond, and actually that was in the Royal Barracks. And he says in his witness statement, actually Barton says in his witness statement, that Colonel Esmond actually confined him to barracks duties because he knew where my sympathies lay. He knew where my sympathies lay. Now, I think that's a very telling little sentence there, because I think we already have got a nationalist Barton, okay, coming in now in the aftermath of the revolution. Now, he wasn't a Republican as yet, but I think, okay, very certainly his experiences in the next little while would actually shape his conversion, if you like, to Republicanism.
So, Chris, what you're suggesting, Chris, is this is not a sudden conversion, quote unquote, but it's a journey, that overused word, sorry, listeners, but he's on this journey towards a more radical nationalist position. Now, mention has been made several times here. I just want to bring John Dorney in on this, right, because mention has already been made several times of his cousin Erskine Childers. Now, John, would I be right in assuming that we're more like brothers than cousins? I mean, that they spent a lot of time together from a very young age. So, like, are we talking about the two of them in lockstep in terms of their evolution, their political evolution?
I mean, yeah, it's similar. I mean, there's kind of, I agree with most of what Chris has said. I think, though, that there's some things to iron out, maybe, which is that, like, I think that they were certainly converts to Home Rule, both Robert and Erskine were. And of course, you know, Erskine is possibly the more militant before the First World War. Him and his wife, Molly, were involved in importing arms at Howth, of course, in 1914. Now, did they see that, though, in separatist terms? I'm not sure they did. And, you know, there's an interesting thing about the early volunteer movement. You know, there are a lot of kind of grandees involved, like Maurice Moore, again, is a landed gentry from County Mayo. He's a nationalist again of sorts, but like not of the bent that comes to be the, you know, the dominant strand, which is a kind of, you know, the term populist has been polluted lately, but a kind of a populist nationalism in the sense that it believes that the real people of Ireland are, you know, the plain people, the landless people and so on. And by the time we get to the, you know, Republic declared in 1919, the likes of Robert Barton and Erskine Childers are kind of exceptions. Now, are they in lockstep? Yeah, it's very similar. But the other thing I was going to say is, in terms of they both joined in the First World War, but so did, of course, many nationalists. And remember, the Home Rule movement is more complex in its attitude than the separatist movement. So, you know, a lot of them did believe in the idea of the freedom of small nations, and this was a war against German militarism and aggression and so on. And I suspect, you know, that they might have joined up in the First World War on that basis. But I mean, on the other hand, they did, as I mentioned before, you know, come from a place of British kind of empire loyalism. So what's interesting, I suppose, as well, is I do agree with Chris's point, but what's interesting, though, is how it's portrayed. Like, for example, in Dorothy McArdle, you know, she writes that he was in charge of the prisoners who were processed after the Easter Rising, and that their stoicism and self-sacrifice before they were executed, like he saw some of the leaders before they were executed, and that this converted them to the national cause. Now, like Chris, I don't think that's the case. You know, I think that's a dramatization, but it's very interesting, and it shows you the power of the myth of 1916, that it was this thunderbolt that changed everybody. You know, changed anyone who had any contact with it, almost like, you know, Christian martyrs in early Rome kind of thing.
John, is there a danger, you know, that some of these memoirs are rationalizations after the fact? Do you know what I mean? That Barton, in his bureau statement, you know, will exaggerate possibly, you know, early nationalist influences.
Yeah, but I mean, I do think that is the case. I mean, that's always the case. On the other hand, you know, it's incontrovertible that both him and Erskine and his sister, Dulcibella, were involved in the Home Rule movement, including in the arming of the volunteers in Howth. So, you know, clearly they did have links in that direction. But like,
when did he actually join Sinn Féin?
So he joined Sinn Féin. Now, the thing is, I mean, undoubtedly, though, the experience of the Rising and its aftermath, and he did meet many of the leaders before they were executed. Like, he didn't see Connolly's execution, but he saw him just before his execution, for example. And he talks in his statement, about how, you know, he talks about the details of the famous story of Connolly being strapped to the chair and that. Now, he continued to serve in the army, but he was never sent to a combat unit, which is interesting. So I think there is something to do with the fact that they knew he had nationalist inklings. And he was released from the army in May 1918, before the end of the war, just at the time of the conscription crisis. So again, it is a kind of an indication that he probably was against conscription and he did participate in that campaign. But in answer to your question, Tommy, he joined Sinn Féin, to the best of my knowledge, in and around May 1918.
May 1918. Now, at that stage, they definitely were Republican. Chris, you want to come in on that very quickly?
Yeah, well, I suppose actually just to say that Barton's witness, I suppose his statement is actually not the only one which will give us, some of the details of how he behaved when he was in Richmond Barracks and when he was there actually in the aftermath of the rising. Because we see some of the other witness statements as well, actually by the ex-prisoners who were saying that he was, a very, very civil to them. He treated them very well. He was very kind to them. And that he had long conversations with some of the other Republicans. For example, Darrell Figgis, who, of course, was also involved in the Haute gunrunning. And so they would have actually known each other beforehand. As John said there, they did, Barton did know actually quite a lot of the nationalist leaders. And so therefore, you can see that some of these witnesses, for example, you've got Robert Kinsella, William O'Brien, the Labour leader, of course, Mrs. Bat O'Connor, and Hugh Hare. If you look to Hugh Hare's statement, it's a very interesting one because he said that Robert Barton got very friendly with Republican prisoners and that he had no doubt that Barton's interaction with these was responsible for what he called his very national outlook, which he adopted later on. So I think there is no doubt that, his time in Richmond Barracks did have a profound influence on Barton's conversion, if you like to use that word, to a more militant republicanism.
Yeah, so the point you make, Chris, is that there's numerous evidence in the
Oh, yes, it's not just the one source. It's not just one. Statement. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Now, Joan, I want to just come to you, right, because John Dorney has said to us that Robert Barton joined Sinn Féin in 1918. Now, by then, they were definitely a Republican organization. Now, this is a man who's lost two brothers in the First World War, right? So how did this go down with his family, John? Do we know anything about that?
Well, certainly the family would have had a tradition, as John has said, of being, loyalist family. The family were magistrates, his father, grandfather before him. So there was certainly a tradition of loyalty to the establishment and to Dublin Castle. In his memoirs, he doesn't really mention anything as such about his family and the reaction of the family, but he does mention about the butler, a man called Strickland, who he said was a bigotist, Protestant and loyalist, and that he was heartbroken when Robert and Erskine went over to the nationalist side. And he recounts a story where he was sending a message to somebody and he wrote, God save Ireland. And Strickland, the butler, changed it to God save the King. So certainly the butler wasn't very happy with the way that Robert Barton went from being a loyalist family into a nationalist one.
Now, sorry, can I bring Chris in on just moving on to the 1918 general election? Chris, first of all, why was he chosen as the candidate? I mean, was there an element of social deference involved here, that you pick a prominent landlord?
Now, that is a difficult question. Yeah, there may have been. But I think, if we look at the rest of the candidates right around the country, social deference wasn't a major consideration. So therefore, I think, in Barton's case, it is possible. But I think possibly what is more to the point is his relationship with, Darrell Figgis. Now, Darrell Figgis had become the secretary of the new Sinn Féin, if you like. Interestingly, actually, Barton wasn't quite around to the Sinn Féin worldview yet as such. Late 1917 into 1918, he supported, if you like, the Irish Convention. And it was really when it failed that he actually saw that there would be no hope now for home rule because of the fact that the conference had failed and so forth. And so he looked, I think, maybe then to Sinn Féin. Now, Sinn Féin had actually boycotted the convention, of course. And I suppose, you know, Fégus, as we've already seen, was actually well known to Barton. Okay, Barton himself actually thinks, looking at his witness statement, okay, Barton himself thinks that it was actually Fégus who actually put his name forward for running in the 1918 election. Either way, there's no doubt that he did very well in the election. And he was basically part of that Sinn Féin landslide, if you like, which swept away the Home Rule Party and actually brought Sinn Féin into power.
Now,
at least into office.
Yeah, he won 82% of the vote. I mean, that's a massive, massive vote.
Oh, it's huge, yes. Yeah,
It does give you an idea of what would have happened if all of the seats had been opposed. You know, about 25 Sinn Féiners were returned unopposed. So we can assume that if there had been contested elections, that's the order of magnitude of the vote they would have gotten. John Dorney, can I move on to you now, right? Because after the 1918 general election victory, Dáil-Éireann assembles in January 1919 and an underground government is set up. Now, Barton is Minister for Agriculture. How effective or active was he in that role?
Well, his great achievement was the idea of a land bank. Now, you know, Chris mentioned this earlier on, that, you know, part of his and Erskine Childers and people like Horace Plunkett's conception of Irish self-government was that you would have, you know, a remedy for rural poverty. So one of the initiatives they had was a land bank where the Dáil would give loans, I think, for land purchase. So it's an extension in some ways of British policy, but the idea is it's going to be more extensive. I mean, the idea as well is like that Barton and the Barton Childers family were not just landlords, they were actually farmers as well. You know, they were quite successful farmers, which is not, you know, universal for landlords. Sometimes landlords didn't farm the land at all. No, often they were absentee, of course. Now, in terms of how successful he was quite well regarded. I mean, one comment I would make about his rise and also the likes of Childers and before him Casement to a degree is that not so much social deference, but that people were perhaps impressed, almost intimidated by their education. So, you know, they'd been educated at Oxford and so on. And I think that people were to a degree intimidated by this. Barton mentions that Griffith in particular was intimidated by Childers' education. But in terms of how successful he was in jail, though, for most of the War of Independence, because he was indicted, to use the American word, but he was wanted for a speech that he made in County Wicklow in late 1919, where he talked about, you know, we talked about the repression of the Second Dáil. The Second Dáil had just been banned. He talked about the repression of the First Dáil. The First Dáil was banned in September 1919. And he apparently threatened the life of Sir John French, who was the Lord Lieutenant, but at the time the kind of military governor of Ireland. And there was an attempt on John French's life near the Phoenix Park about a month later. Actually, you know, Barton wasn't in that end of the movement. That was Collins. But, you know, there was a writ put out for his arrest. He was arrested. He was imprisoned. He escaped, actually, from Mountjoy Jail. But he was arrested again in January 1920, and this time for good. So he was in jail from January 1920 until July 1921. So he was actually deported to England, and he was held in Portland and Portsmouth jails. So he had no chance to be effective, unfortunately, for most of the War of Independence in the civil administration of Dáil-Éireann.
Now, I want to move on to Catherine now for another aspect of this, you know, counter-state set up by Sinn Féin. And that's at the local government level, Catherine, because we had there were local government elections in 1920. Now, what happened in Wicklow, and was Barton involved in that, either directly or indirectly?
Well, the local government elections, basically a landslide victory for Sinn Féin candidates in that election, and it enabled the new Department of Local Government in the first Dáil to essentially call on councils to abandon the British Local Government Board and pledge allegiance to the new Dáil, the new Dáil Éireann. So essentially county councils were pledging allegiance. We have most councils, you'll find a statement in their minute books, and it's the same for County Wicklow, where they resolve to pledge allegiance. And there's also an official statement in the minutes regarding Robert Barton's imprisonment and their official objection to it. Just to quote very quickly, this was the AGM of the Wicklow County Council on the 18th of June 1920. As a protest against this inhuman treatment and as proof that the Irish patriot in an English prison is ever dear to his people, we hereby confer on R.C. Barton the highest honour it is our gift to bestow, that of chairman of this council. So they make Robert Barton, while he is still in prison, the chairman of Wicklow County Council, and it would have been indeed the highest honour they could bestow on Barton. The county councils essentially, because they turned their back on the British Local Government Board, it meant that they no longer had the funding and the grants from the local government board, and they essentially had to administer their finances underground, as it were. And certainly in Wicklow, you had rate collectors and council officials who would have been arrested and imprisoned. The secretary of Wicklow County Council, Simon J. Doyle, he is said to have died prematurely just from the strain of trying to carry out, keep the council going under these conditions. So they were heady times. It's very interesting to see the various correspondence with the new Dáil Éireann in our local archives here in Wicklow.
I'm presuming then that Barton's position as chairman of the council, this was an honorary recognition. He'd no direct role in local government at this stage.
No. It was essentially a way of the council, marking very clearly their support for Barton and for Sinn Féin and for Dáil Éireann.
Now, John Dorney, moving back to you now, I presume he was released then after the truce in July 1921, or when was released, John?
What's interesting, the timing actually, Tommy, because first, it's probably counterintuitive, to use another fashionable term, but most prisoners weren't released under the truce. Very few were, only high-ranking people, including, Sean McKeown, and Barton was one of them. And Barton was released actually just before the truce in order to conduct the negotiations with General MacCready for the terms of the truce. So he was, he was very well regarded as a negotiator.
That was my next question. Why was he picked? Okay, he was picked as a plenipotentiary later, but you're saying he was picked right from the get-go to negotiate the truce itself.
Correct, exactly, yeah. So him and Gavin Duffy and also De Valera, talked directly with General MacCready to negotiate the terms of the truce in the Mansion House in July 1921. Yeah, I mean, his education, his background seems to have impressed people on his own side. He seems to have been well regarded with regard to figures of statesmanship, certainly in the Sinn Féin movement. Now, interestingly enough, I mean, MacCready doesn't have much to say about him, but, Lloyd George, once we do get to London, he is named after as a plenipotentiary, but that's quite consistent, with the high regard he was apparently kept in. He was given a new ministership under the second Dáil once he was released as well, the Minister for Economic Affairs. But Lloyd George wasn't at all impressed with him. Lloyd George said he was a pipsqueak and so on, and he wasn't straight talking.
I have the quote here, John. Why did they bring that pipsqueak of a man Barton with them? I would not make him a secretary to an undersecretary, he said. Now, is that praise coming from Lloyd George, right? Why did Barton annoy him so much?
I think Barton, my impression is that Barton annoyed him because he was insistent on certain points, I think, actually. And Childers is the same thing. Childers and Barton were actually quite
so he was doing his job, essentially.
I think that's true. The other thing is, though, that there was a personal split between, Childers and Barton and Collins and Griffith. They don't seem to have got on personally very well. Barton developed a good relation, and so did Childers, developed a good relationship with Eamon de Valera in this period of the truce, close relationship. And as we know, personal relationships were kind of starting to break down a little bit within the movement, even at that early point. Like, there was a big dispute over who was in control of the IRA, you know, in the truce period. Was it the civil government or was it the, you know, IRA, GHQ with Collins and Mulcahy? So, you know, Barton wasn't a party to that, but he was close to De Valera. I mean, I think, you know, I think he annoyed Lloyd George, though, because he was insistent on various things. Like, one interesting thing is, you know, the fiscal autonomy thing, that the Free State must have fiscal autonomy. That was also close to Griffith's heart. They were on the same page on that. Barton was much more insistent on guarantees on partition, interestingly enough. And he talks about, you know, that Lloyd George fobbed off Collins and Griffith with the idea of the Boundary Commission. Now, we know how it worked out in the sense that it didn't move the border at all in the end. And Barton apparently came back to this again and again during talks about how will this actually be determined? Like, what guarantees do we have that Boundary Commission will be representative? And he said, will it be a vote by counties? Will it be a vote by poor law unions, county councils? You know, what way will it be? And he says that Lloyd George kind of fobbed him off in the end. So I suppose that was why Lloyd George, he annoyed Lloyd George so much.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's interesting what you say about the Boundary Commission, because, I mean, my impression is, you know, that, or the impression of a lot of people is that the Irish plenipotentiary fell asleep at the wheel in that particular regard, you know, by not looking at the fine print. But what you're saying is that Barton did, put down a marker on this, but he was fobbed off or he was ignored. John, just move on just on the question of, like, how effective a negotiator was he? I mean, can we see his fingerprints in any of the treaty? I'm thinking of the fiscal terms of it, because it did give Ireland fiscal independence.
Yeah, so he was very insistent on that point. Now, that wasn't a point of contention within the delegation, though, because they were all more or less on the same page. They had to have fiscal autonomy. You know, that was a sine qua non. And also, you know, and the military thing, that the Free State would have its own military and police and so on. So certainly, but Barton was quite insistent that these are the points we had to have. Now, I mean, what I would find kind of eccentric or odd about Barton's contribution to the treaty debates was Barton didn't like the final draft of the treaty. He didn't like several things, including the oath, of course. But also, you know, he was quite upset by the idea of the way partition was handled in Article 12 of the treaty. And he said that there wasn't enough guarantees in the Boundary Commission that it would reflect the wishes of the inhabitants. And so him and Gavin Duffy went back, and also the delegation went back and consulted with the cabinet, and him and Gavin Duffy drafted a counter proposal. You know, and this was more to do with the oath, that with the Free State would have external associations. So this is De Valera's idea, really. You know, but not have a direct oath to the British monarchy. And that, you know, this is important, really, from the idea of selling the treaty, I think. Now, this is when the split really happened, because, you know, Collins and Griffith appeared to have decided to sign by then. But what I mentioned was eccentric was Barton then was persuaded to sign, even though he didn't like the final settlement. So he says, Lloyd George made his famous threat of war, and I said I couldn't be responsible for war. You know, I didn't have that authority, so I had to sign. He said, at the time, I believed Lloyd George's threat that it was sign or war, you know, immediately. So there wasn't time to go back and refer it back to the cabinet in Dublin. But again, you know, even though apparently Barton didn't like the final shape of the deal, at the treaty debates, when the Dáil voted on the treaty in January 1922, Barton said, I signed the treaty, so I have to recommend it to you. So I suppose it's this old-fashioned idea of service. You know, it's almost like a British patrician idea that Barton has, that even though I don't particularly like the treaty, I have to recommend it to you. And that, yet again, you know, what's odd, I suppose, is that Barton then stands for the anti-treaty side in the subsequent election. So, you know, I do find that slightly odd, you know, his thinking there.
Chris, can I bring you in on that? Like, if he didn't like the treaty, why did he sign it, right? And then, you know, having signed it and then arguing against it in the subsequent debates, I mean, does the man have any credibility at all?
Yes, I think he does. And I think he did at the time as well, interestingly enough, but I'm going to come on to that in a moment. Looking at his record in relation to the treaty, and actually John mentioned his education there, I think his education meant that he was unlikely to be overawed when he actually met the opposition, if you like. They were equals, and he saw them as equals. And I think that was, in fact, a very, very big, I suppose, thing, if you like, in his being chosen actually to be one of the delegates. Now, of course, in his new Ministry of Economic Affairs as well, it was always likely that he would go and he would be one of the negotiators, because that was a key area of negotiations. He had been director of agriculture. Of course, the directors were not ministers. They didn't actually sit in the cabinet, but this was a new ministry. He was a minister, he was a cabinet member, and of course he was going to go because of that. Now, in the negotiations, he was actually very, very dogged, and he kind of actually harped on, if you like, on the same things. And of course, he was the man to whom I suppose the De Valera actually first mooted this idea of external association as well. So therefore, he was constantly actually bringing forward the external association agenda during the negotiations, as well, of course, as his economic negotiations, where he chipped away little by little at the British, like what they were going to give, trying to look for more. Now, we actually come on then to the fact that there was a treaty actually hammered out, if you like, there were these articles of agreement. And three of the five delegates were now going to sign. Yeah, Collins, yeah, Griffith, and yeah, Duggan were now going to sign. So that left basically Gavin Duffy and Robert Barton. Okay, Duffy basically wavered a bit and he said that he'd be guided by Barton. But of course, they all had to sign for this to be actually binding, if you like. Now, although he wasn't particularly happy and he was actually doing a lot of soul searching, if you like, on the night in question, that long night when eventually it was actually after kind of 2 o'clock in the morning when he did sign. He was the last man to hold out, by the way. But I think in the Dáil afterwards, and I suppose actually when he came back and in the cabinet and in the Dáil meetings afterwards and in the treaty debates, he made it clear that he wasn't acting in a personal capacity. And he said, interestingly enough, that although he wasn't actually happy, the choice was war or peace. And again, you go back to Lloyd George's ultimatum. And a lot has been actually said about this, and like, did he mean it? Would the war have started? Well, I think he did mean it myself. And I think the war would have started. And I think the war would have probably been basically lost by the nationalist side. But that's all kind of conjecture anyway. But I think the big thing is that on the night, it was now or never. And he said that he could not commit, if you like, the nation, and he used the word the nation in the speech to the Dáil. He said that he couldn't commit the nation to war without actually giving the president, who'd be De Valera, and the Dáil the opportunity to see the terms on which war could be avoided. Now, he did say for himself, he preferred war. Now, of course, you go back to the point that was made here about the witness statement being actually made a long time after the event. So, you know, perhaps there is an element of, you know, looking back and exaggerating Republican, credentials, if you like. But at the same time, he felt that he was unable to sign for the very simple reason that he wasn't acting for himself. He was acting as a plenipotentiary for the nation. And so therefore, he decided that he would have to sign this and he would have to bring it back to the cabinet and he would have to bring it back to the Dáil. Of course, in the cabinet, it was passed by a small vote, basically, 3-4, actually. Cosgrave was the surprise. But of course, once again, actually, Robert Barton's actual vote was kind of a casting vote as well. Well, they were all casting votes. There was only one vote in it. And in the Dáil, particularly after the deputies had gone back over to Christmas recess and actually taking the mood of the country, which was basically mostly pro-treaty, it has to be said. Then, of course, in the Dáil, you had got this, again, it was a reasonably tight vote, but 64-57, or whatever it was. And you'll see there that, once again, actually, Barton voted for the treaty. Now, interestingly enough, he said, at the time when he commended the treaty, that he commended it on signature. Arthur Griffith, for example, commended it on merit. So here you had a subtle way, or perhaps not so subtle way, of actually Barton saying, I really don't agree with everything that's in this, but I've signed it. So it's my duty. And he was very big on duty. So it's my duty to actually vote for the treaty. Once he had done his duty, then he felt he was free to go the other way and to actually take the anti-treaty stance then afterwards.
So I'm assuming then he would have withdrawn from the Dáil along with Dev and the other anti-treaty people, Chris.
Yes, well, I suppose he actually voted for the treaty. Later on, though, of course, he basically changed and he took the anti-treaty side afterwards.
Right. Now, OK, so by the spring of 1922, he's firmly in the anti-treaty camp. John, how does he do in the packed election of June 1922?
Yeah, well, he's elected again for County Wicklow in the 1922 election. You know, it's a slightly different election. It's under PR now. And the pact does hold, as far as I know, in County Wicklow in 1922. You know, there are rival candidates from other parties. You know, I just on the treaty, though, I mean, there's a couple of interesting things that Barton says. I mean, first of all, his thing that he says he would have preferred war himself, but it wasn't his responsibility. He doesn't only say that in the witness statement. He says that in the Dáil debates in either late 21 or early 22. So that's his position. You know, he would have been prepared to go to war, but against the treaty, but he said he didn't have that responsibility. The other thing, though, is, you know, in his Whitsun statement, which is obviously much later and it's a retrospective, he does say maybe the idea of a stepping stone, you know, had merit, because that's what eventually happened. You know, he whittled away against most of the things that we didn't like in the treaty, except for partition and the boundary commission. And he says that was the one point where I feel we got it wrong. So that's kind of interesting in hindsight. But Barton, yeah, is very much tied to the anti-treaty side. And interestingly, I find is that, you know, people didn't seem to hold it against him that he had actually signed the treaty. But I must say, I find that kind of strange. Again, I must say also, I don't really understand his position that having signed the treaty, that then he was prepared to be, you know, in opposition to it. But I suppose Barton would have said, along with many kind of civilian anti-treatyites, that the intention was never to oppose it by arms. You know, the intention was, you know, that we are against aspects of it that we hope to resolve politically. And that was certainly De Valera's position. Now, Barton talks in his witness statement, and I think it's quite true, that De Valera and the political anti-treaty side were never in control of the army, you know, and never in control of the faction of the army that occupied the forecourts and so on. And that was really what was driving events and destabilizing events in 1922.
Now, John, he was made Minister for Economic Affairs in Dev's underground government. I mean, was that a dead letter from the get-go?
Yeah, it pretty much was, to be honest. I mean, you know, when the Civil War broke out, and, you know, the anti-treaty Republican narrative of the outbreak of the Civil War, is that they didn't start the Civil War at all, that it was the Free State that attacked the forecourts unprovoked. Now, you know, we don't have to choose partisan sides on that anymore, but that's the way they saw it. And he was arrested after the forecourts fighting. He went into O'Connell Street. Whether he held a gun or not, I don't know, but he was arrested after he went back to the Childers' house in Terenure. He escaped from there, and then he was on the run in his own house in Wicklow, but also in other places. And yeah, in October 1922, what happens there, Tommy, is that Liam Lynch, who was the chief of staff of the anti-treaty IRA, says to De Valera, you know, we need a civil side for the legitimacy of our cause. You know, we need a provisional Republican government. And so De Valera goes about setting one up. But like the war effort, if you like, and all the policy decisions are really taken by Lynch and by the IRA executive. So it is a dead letter even within the anti-treaty movement to a large extent. Also, it's totally unlike the counter-state of the First Dáil, because they have no real authority. You know, they can't do any of the things that the First Dáil did in terms of taking over local government or taking over policing or anything like that. So it really is a symbolic thing. And the other thing, of course, is that Barton is arrested, you know, in a matter of weeks after October 1922, when they did set up this kind of oppositional Republican government.
Now, move on to one of the most tragic episodes in this whole story is the execution of Erskine Childers. Joan, can I bring you in on this? I mean, okay, this is a man who's lost two brothers in the First World War. He's now, you know, he's losing his cousin, who's like his brother. I mean, was he bitter about the execution of Erskine Childers?
Whether he was bitter, I'm not an expert on the military side of this, but I reckon he must have been quite bitter. Here was, you know, people who had fought side by side, and now they had taken his cousin, his brother in arms, or his brother, almost his brother, and executed him. Having said that, Erskine Childress himself was not a bitter man, and as is widely known, called on his eldest son, Erskine Jr., the night before his execution, and, you know, told him he was not to take revenge, and he was not to use his death in any way to his advantage. So whether Robert Barton was bitter, I can't attest to that, but certainly it must have had an extreme, profound effect on him. Others, John and Chris, may know more about this than I would. But
John, do you want to come in on that?
Yes, Tommy. I mean, one thing I'd like to say kind of about the execution of Erskine Childress is it was an unusually kind of personal thing to pick out Childress to be executed. Like, in the Civil War, we now have a count of like 83 official executions, you know, by firing squad. Now, of those, you know, Erskine Childress is really the only high-ranking political anti-treaty guy to be killed. You know, there's the four IRA executive leaders, or three and one, in December 1922, but that's totally different circumstances. That's their reprisal for the assassination of Sean Hale's TD. Now, outside of that, it's a very interesting pattern. You have really people who are very low-ranking, often very young, who were executed, often people who had been too young to fight in the War of Independence, who seem to be picked out. Now, Childress, you know, had not committed any, you know, atrocities or anything like that. He's found with a pistol, you know, in the house in Animo in County Wicklow. And there does seem to have been a degree of personal animus, you know, which is very unusual. And, you know, many people were remarking this at the time, that Griffith in particular, Griffith's dead, of course, but Griffith in particular hated Childress, and, you know, they called him an Englishman and so on, and that they blamed him for the whole thing. You know, this thing of like Childress was an outsider by his background, and that's why he was selected. So, you know, I won't comment on that, and I don't want to attribute personal malice, but I think the family and their supporters, and also other anti-treaty Republicans, did see it in that light, that there was a degree of personal animus in executing Erskine Childress, because he wasn't a senior military figure, really. You know, he was the director of publicity for the anti-treaty side. He was on the run in County Wicklow, and there was, you know, there was certainly no military reason to execute him, I wouldn't say.
Okay, listen, just moving on now, right? So he's in jail then for most of the Civil War, I take it. Now, there's a general election after the Civil War, 1923. Chris, how does Barton do in the 1923 election?
Well, yes, he is actually, I suppose, held in captivity for all of the Civil War, almost. And interestingly, he really says nothing about that at all in the witness statement. And he makes no reference either to the execution of Erskine Childress, which is possibly a bit unusual. But he just basically said nothing at all about it in the witness statement. I suppose the witness, statements really themselves are as important for what they don't say sometimes as for what they do say. Anyway, yes, there was an election in 1923, and Barton did not do well. He lost his seat, and he actually polled just about half, well, slightly over half of the actual votes of Christopher Byrne, who was basically topped the poll, and then you had the Labour man and you had the Farmers' Party, Wilson and Everett also got in. Barton lost his seat. And after that, he never again actually stood for election. It was a recognition that the mood of the country had changed. Perhaps it was a reaction, if you like, to what had happened actually during the course of the Civil War. We know that in his later years, he was basically haunted by his decision to actually sign the treaty, and by the Civil War that followed, and by like the loss of young lives and so forth. So I suppose, yeah, perhaps that was beginning. And he really goes into the wilderness, if you like. Well, he goes back home, basically, for about a decade.
Does he join Fianna Fáil, Chris?
Later on, yes. After the 1932 election, he actually comes back into public life, but not in politics, however. And he campaigns very vigorously for Fianna Fáil in the 1933 election. But again, he is not involved, if you like, directly. He is not going to be a candidate, but he lends them his absolute support. And I think this goes back a lot, if you like, to his relationship with De Valera. He was always perceived as being a De Valera man, and I think there was a lot of truth in that. He was perceived as being a De Valera man when he was back negotiating in London. And he accompanied Dev on, I suppose, a number of different things. But interestingly, I think the only time really that he criticized Dev was when he was actually coming back and he was actually speaking in the Dáil and so forth afterwards, after he'd actually signed the treaty. He thought that Dev actually should have gone to London for the end game. And he said, okay, not in so many words, but he said that like the mess was of Dev's making. And like that was very interesting because although he was a Dev man, he was not a yes man. And so therefore you can see that he was quite prepared to actually stand up to Dev and to like to make his points known and so forth. And I think that looking at this, I mean, he did agree with the original decision for Dev to stay at home. But, okay, when things were coming to the 11th hour, he thought that that should have been reversed. However, okay, to go back to 1933, after that, he does actually campaign for Fianna Fáil, and he certainly actually comes back into public life later on. All right, okay, De Valera, for example, makes him a director of the Irish Press. And he's also, Sean McEntee appoints him to the board of the ACC, which really could be, I suppose, a kind of a nod to his land bank days back when he was involved in setting up the land bank and so forth. And, of course, his educational background and his education in the agricultural, college in Cirencester, for example. All these things basically were involved. But, of course, he also actually just, I suppose you to mention this, he was one of the, I suppose, like one of the things that he was appointed to also was actually the Turf Development Board, which actually melded into Bord na Mona, merged into Bord na Mona, morphed is the word I'm looking for, morphed into Bord na Mona actually later on. And he does an awful lot of good work with the development of the bogs and like particularly in the Midlands. Now, this is, basically from the 30s up to about 1960 or so when he retires. But, okay, certainly you can see that although he wasn't involved directly in politics, he was actually given these positions by Fianna Fáil, okay, by De Valera and in one case by McEntee. And I suppose you could see this as a reward, basically, for his ongoing support, if you like, during the formative years of the state.
Tony, you want to come in on that?
Tommy, I would agree with Chris there that he, you know, was very much seen as a De Valera man from the very beginning. And yes, he did criticise Dev and saying, you know, the tragedy that followed the treaty negotiations was of Dev's making. But he remained firm friends with De Valera throughout his life. And some of the people that I have spoken to locally, such as Noel Curley and Breda Healy, Breda Cullen and Teresa Healy, who worked in the estate, said that De Valera would have often visited and stayed for dinner. And that in turn, the Bartons, Robert and his wife, Rachel, would have visited Orisanutaron when Dev was president, and also would have visited Roundwood Park, which is just a few miles over the road where Sean T. O'Kelly lived. So he was very much still in contact with De Valera and some of his former comrades like Sean T. O'Kelly. But to go back to, you know, his kind of leaving public life as such, I think that the death of Erskine must have had a profound effect on him, and the subsequent loss of life of a lot of young men. And one of the things he had talked about early on when he was in the British Army during the First World War, he talked about how while the estate and the farm was being run by his sister, Dulcibella, he wished he was there because he could have ploughed more acreage and he could have got more work done. And I think he was very much devoted to the estate. And as John said, you know, the Bartons farmed their estate rather than just setting it out to tenants. And he was very, very involved with running the estate. And even up to in his 90s, he died when he was 94 in 1975. Every morning at 8 o'clock, he stood in the yard and the bell was rung and all the jobs for the day were allocated to the men. And depending on, you know, what accounts you read, he either employed, you know, anything from 20 to 50 men on the estate, with at least 6 women working in the house. So it was a very big employer. And as one person said to me, he didn't really need all of those men, but everyone was employed because he wanted to be able to give employment to local people. So I think he really concentrated on the estate, but was happy to take on roles like chairman of the various boards that he was appointed to, the Turf Development Board, which was later Board Namona, and working within the ACC. So I think he was happy to do his duty, but not necessarily to stand in public life.
Okay, can I bring Catherine in there? Catherine, have you anything to add on his later career from the archives?
Well, there is a very interesting letter from the Sinn Féin West Wicklow Corla Ciantar. It's dated 8th of June 1924, and I think it sums up very nicely the Sinn Féin attitude to Robert and his part in the treaty, and very much of the time. I mean, 1924, this was all very recent past to them. I'll just read a very short extract. It's a 3-page letter, but I'll just read a couple of lines by May. As regards the Irish delegation of 1921, no Republican has any delusions as to the part you then took in these deliberations and the subsequent signing of the treaty. We are not in a position to judge the motives which prompted the signatories. We honour and appreciate the steps you took to rectify the decision which was forced upon you then. If your example had been followed by the other delegates, the country would have been spared the agony and bitterness of the past 2 years. I think it's a quite a telling letter, the sincere wishes to persuade him not to leave public life from the Corla Ciantar. I think it speaks very well to the attitude that a lot of Republicans would have had towards Robert, certainly in County Wicklow.
Now, just to wrap things up here, he died on the 29th of August 1975, age 94. Coincidentally, 19 days after Dev passed away, he was the last of the 5 signatories to die as well. John Dorney, just to wrap up, how would you sum up his career? And in particular, I'm thinking of, you know, this phenomenon of Protestant republicanism, because it seems to me it's often just regarded as a kind of an exotic aberration, right? I mean, is there something more than that?
You know, I have a number of thoughts about this, Tommy. You know, first of all, though, I mean, Irish Protestants, including Southern Irish Protestants, were not a homogenous group. Like, so even, for example, you know, people who were quite close geographically, like George Gilmore, for example, who was originally from the north of Ireland, but he was a Protestant and he was a member of the IRA in South County Dublin. Yeah, and later on, very prominent kind of socialist Republican in the 1930s, you know, people who continued to regard like the revolution as unfinished. They wouldn't have had a great deal in common, you know, in any way, really, with Robert Barton, apart from the fact, I suppose, that they were for periods on the same side. Now, you know, if you look at the experience of the kind of Southern Irish gentry, the landed gentry, of whom the Barton Childers are a part, one thing that strikes me about this is if you look at how well regarded Childers and Barton were, certainly up to the treaty anyway, by all sides in the Republican movement, it strikes me that maybe there was a missed opportunity for that class, you know, and not trying to take a lead in the national movement, you know, that they lost their prominence, you know, afterwards. You know, if we look at from the time of Parnell, and then we look at the experience of people like the Childers Barton family, there perhaps was an opening for these people that they didn't take. You know, it might have been a political opportunity. But they were, you know, they weren't the majority of Southern Irish Protestants, but it would be wrong to say that it's, you know, it's an exotic aberration, because, you know, there was a considerable kind of Protestant opinion that was nationalist or Republican, or, you know, of various strands. It's wrong to project backwards the Northern Ireland conflict, where, you know, such things are perceived as very black and white, you know, very one or the other. It wasn't that way at the time. There was a range of choices open to people, I think.
Okay, I think we'll leave it there. I mean, I think there's more to be said about Robert Barton, most interesting character. I'd just like to thank our panel here today, John Dorney, Joan Kavanagh, Chris Lawler, and Catherine Wright. Listeners, our next Hedge School will be a live one, well, we hope it will, on 3 p.m. Thursday, the 6th of January. That'll be held in the Chapel Royal in Dublin Castle. And it's on the topic of, quote, Dublin Castle has fallen, unquote, the handover, 16th of January, 1922. Hope you can come along to that or tune into the podcast. Thank you very much.